WWF superstars compete in the Royal Rumble for the undisputed WWF Championship, including Jake the Snake Roberts, the Barbarian, the Model Rick Martel, the Berserker, Rowdy Roddy Piper, Hacksaw Jim Duggan, Nasty Boy Stag, Repo Man, Sergeant Slaughter, alleged real world champion Ric Flair, Hercules, Colonel Mustafa, the Macho Man Randy Savage, Skinner, the British Bulldog Davey Boy Smith, the Million Dollar Man Ted DiBiase, Haku, Shawn Michaels, the Warlord, El Matador, Sid Justice, IRS, Nikolai Volkov, the Texas Tornado, Virgil, the Undertaker, the Big Boss Man, Greg the Hammer Valentine, Superfly Snooker, and the immortal Hulk Hogan. It's time to rumble! It's time for the Royal Rumble!
You're listening to The Sound Off. The Sound Off. With the Solomonster. Solomonster.
I think you're starting to believe in your own bullshit, Hogan.
The party must be over. Patterson's here with Briscoe.
What?
You need to hit them sit-ups, too. You're not exactly leanest. But guess seeing me, bro, you can't see your own penis. Woo!
That was the original intro to the 1992 Royal Rumble, not that edited bullshit that they've put out on some of their DVDs in recent years with Mean Gene doing the voiceovers. That was Vince McMahon at his finest. 1992, still the greatest Rumble match of all time. And in fact, they have the Intercontinental title match between Roddy Piper and the Mountie on their Classics on Demand channel, which, as a match, pretty much sucked. But it was still one of the better moments in WWE history, seeing Roddy Piper, who had been this big star and had never won a belt in the company, winning the Intercontinental Championship. I love that show. Can only hope the 2011 Royal Rumble can be just as good. It's coming up next Sunday, but right now this is episode 143 of The Sound Off here on SEScoops.com for Sunday, January 23rd, 2011. I am the Solomonster, and we apparently are in for the biggest Royal Rumble ever this year. 40 superstars instead of the usual 30 will be competing in the over-the-top rope battle royale, I guess you would call it, coming up next Sunday. Two title matches, of course, Randy Orton and The Miz for the WWE Championship. Dolph Ziggler in the biggest match of his career, challenging Edge for the World Heavyweight Championship. And I think for the Rumble match, I'm pretty sure they did make mention of the fact that there would be 90-second intervals. So the big question is, why is it happening, and is it going to make the Rumble better or worse? The reason it's happening is because it's purely a marketing gimmick. They want to be able to market this Rumble as the biggest Rumble ever, and they can do so by adding 10 guys to it, even if these 10 guys have absolutely no shot of winning the Rumble match itself. I mean, out of the 40 guys, you can honestly pluck out, and we don't know the names of all of the participants just yet, and I'm sure there's going to be some surprises. I expect Triple H to be a surprise entrance in the Royal Rumble. Wouldn't shock me to see somebody like Bret Hart perhaps be a surprise entrance, although as I told somebody on Twitter, I'm not quite sure how he would be able to take a bump over the top rope. You can make it safe, but anytime you're bumping over the top rope, it's there's an element of danger in that, so I don't know about Bret being able to do that, but that wouldn't surprise me at all. And maybe, you know, we've had people in the past like Honky Tonk Man and Roddy Piper and Jimmy Snuka, and you've got 40 slots in this Rumble match. There's going to be some surprises, but realistically, when you look at the roster of people already announced, you've got John Cena, you've got Alberto Del Rio. Those are people who have a shot. Cena is my pick right now. Not that I want him to win the Rumble again, but it just seems that he would be the favorite if you were a betting person. So we know why they're doing it, but is it going to make the match better or is it going to make the match worse? A lot of people upset about this. They feel that by having all these extra bodies in there, the Rumble intervals may be shortened greatly, although, like I said, they're saying 90 seconds. I think it'll probably end up being more like a minute. Whenever the Rumble takes place, if they're running out of time, they're going to shave time off those intervals anyway. My only concern when it comes to having more guys in there, because again, having more guys in there is not the worst thing in the world, and you know, hey, I mean, it's more people that get on pay-per-view, so good for them. But the Rumble, when you have a couple of people in the ring and it builds and it builds, and you have too many bodies in there, it can get a little clunky. I know they've done a 40-man battle royal at least once before, and that was even worse. Because this thing with the Battle Royal, everybody is in the ring at the start. So, I believe I have it on one of my old Coliseum home videos from like 1992, and I'm pretty sure Tatanka was the winner. It was a 40-man Battle Royal, and you look at this when it starts, and there's so many bodies in the ring that you can't do anything more than just throw some punches and start throwing guys out. You know, you don't have that much room. They're not going to do, you know, a two-ring or three-ring Battle Royal like WCW used to do. So that would be my only concern. If I like it when the ring fills up with guys, but not too much. And if you're going to have more guys, you're either going to have one of two things. Either the ring is going to fill up a little too much, and it's going to be way too crowded in there. Or you're going to have guys just throwing guys out left and right. Rapid-fire eliminations, which I don't like. I don't like rapid-fire eliminations. So I will reserve judgment. I will likely be ordering the pay-per-view next Sunday, and I'll see for myself. It's the first time they're doing it. It may be the only time they do it if it doesn't work out to their satisfaction. But, you know, it's a good gimmick to have because, you know, the Royal Rumble is known for having 30 guys. Now you're tacking on 10. Theoretically, you're giving 10 new guys the opportunity to go to the main event of WrestleMania, even though you and I both know that that's horseshit. Again, there's a very limited number of guys who have a real shot of winning this thing. From what I understand, Christian is not going to be a surprise entrant in the Rumble. And in fact, WWE is operating under the assumption that he may not even be at WrestleMania. So that tells me that he may be healing a little slower than expected from his pectoral surgery. Unless, of course, this is all just a work and he'll pop up at the Rumble as a surprise. But it doesn't seem like that's going to happen. So that's the status of the Royal Rumble. 40 men this year. And I guess the only real question is, will they allow some of the participants in the singles matches on the card to also be in the Rumble? So perhaps if somebody like Randy Orton, for example, loses against The Miz, which I expect him to, can he pop up in the Rumble match? You know, same for Dolph Ziggler. And it's not unheard of. I mean, it used to actually be that way. In fact, the Rumble I referenced earlier where Roddy Piper won the Intercontinental title in 92, the big theme of the show, well, one of the themes of the show, was that could Piper be the first man to win the world title at the same time as being the Intercontinental Champion. Now, of course, I hear them saying that on commentary, and I say to myself, have they forgotten the Ultimate Warrior from a couple of years earlier? And, of course, they didn't. They just, you know, they went out of their way not to mention that Warrior had already done that once before. But Piper was in the Rumble match. You know, he had as good a shot as any to walk out of there as the WWF Champion that night. The title was vacant. Maybe they'll allow some guys to pull double duty at the pay-per-view next week, and we'll have even more big stars in there. We could have Cena in there maybe with Orton, and maybe they'll have a little bit of a face-off. So we shall see. Now, Raw for Monday night didn't do a great job of making me want to see the Rumble, even though I'll probably be getting it anyway. You know, the stuff they did with Orton and Dolph Ziggler, I just don't understand. Kind of makes me scratch my head. You know, here's a guy in Dolph Ziggler that they really want to get behind. And this match that he's going to have with Edge next Sunday is a very important match for him because one bad performance, one slip on the banana peel, and that could be it for him. You know, there's people backstage that have very short attention spans, and they're not very patient people. And they're just waiting for you to fuck up. And as soon as you fuck up, they get to turn around and say, "See, I told you so. This guy can't handle it." I like Dolph. I said it before on this show, last week or the week before, that he has had a string of great matches in 2010 leading into 2011. He really turned into a performer that I enjoyed watching. You know, and I don't watch SmackDown all the time, so I haven't seen every Dolph Ziggler match that he's had over the last year. But I've seen a lot of good ones. And he's a great bump taker. He's very entertaining to watch in the ring. You know, Vicky, as his manager, she's a heat magnet, so obviously, you know, it certainly only helps him, although I do wonder, you know, with somebody like Vicky, I will never call Vicky Guerrero a good promo, but she has nuclear heat, and, I mean, people just hate her, and I think, I can't help but think that somebody like her would be better suited to be paired off with a heel who actually can't speak. You know, you have these green guys being brought up who can't cut a promo for their life. those are the people that would benefit from having a manager or a girlfriend in this case. Dolph Ziggler, I mean, as a promo, he's fine. In fact, he's one of the more entertaining aspects of NXT, which I don't watch every week for my own health, but when I do, Dolph has been very funny. So, again, he's in a very, very important spot next Sunday. He comes through with a great match with Edge, and the crowd is going to have as much to do with that as anything else. One bad crowd can fuck things up as well. But he does well next Sunday. Not going to win the title, but if he does well, there's been some talk of perhaps him and Edge being paired off again at WrestleMania. Now, that's what I've heard. I don't necessarily believe that. They may think that now, but I cannot see Dolph Ziggler being given a straight WrestleMania title match with Edge. I'd love to see it, but I just don't see them doing that. The point is, they put him in the ring with Randy Orton. So it was basically a battle of the two number one contenders this past week for their respective titles. Orton is the challenger to the WWE title, and Dolph is going to be wrestling for the world title. And they go out there, and they have a match, which was, you know, was fine. It wasn't great or anything like that. And Orton beats Dolph Ziggler clean. Clean as a sheet with the RKO in the middle of the ring, 1-2-3. Now, I am as much a fan of clean finishes as the next guy. I think it's great when you have a match between two guys and you actually have a decisive winner. I think it's fantastic. In this case, why make the fucking match in the first place? What is there to be gained by making Dolph Ziggler look bad? You know, and you might say, well, there's nothing wrong with losing to a top guy like Randy Orton, but there is. I mean, you're trying to convince people that this guy has a legitimate shot, that he deserves to be in the main event facing Edge for the title on pay-per-view. And you put him out there, and you just have him just get beaten down like everybody else. Boom, 1-2-3 by Randy Orton. I just don't understand it. Why make the match in the first place? You can make the match and have a fuck finish, but if you don't want to do that, then why make the match? Why not do some sort of tag match? Why bother having Dolph on Raw? He's a SmackDown guy. Keep him on his own show. So I didn't like that at all. I really didn't like that at all. What I did like was the main event with John Cena and CM Punk. I thought they had a damn good 15-minute match. They surprised me. I really did not expect them to give that match away. That's basically what they did. I mean, I figured that either the match wasn't going to happen, or we were going to get some sort of quick screw job. And in fact, not only did we did get a screw job. We actually got, I'm not sure they ever announced the winner. I mean, my take is that Punk must have won by DQ, but they never made the announcement. But we got a long wrestling match between the two of them. Probably the longest match that the two of them have ever had. And they've had one or two matches in the past, I believe. It was a really good match. And I popped when Punk put the Koji Clutch submission on Cena. It's a submission hold that actually looked like it was damaging the other person. What a concept. John Cena could take a lesson from this. I could crow about, you know, giving the match away for free on TV when this, I would have paid money to see these two guys go at it on pay-per-view. There was talk of maybe Cena and Punk having a match at WrestleMania, and it still might happen. It's not like you can't have them have a rematch at Mania. But I'm not going to complain about it too much because it was a great match. And it served a purpose in that at the end of the match, we saw the debut of a new superstar. And we saw the debut of Mason Ryan, whose real name is Barry Griffiths. This is the guy who's been down in Florida Championship Wrestling as their champion for the last 8 months or so. And he's the guy that is almost a dead ringer for Dave Bautista. Not exactly, but he definitely resembles Big Dave Bautista. And that's the only reason they've rushed him up to the main roster, believe it or not. That's the logic they've used. He's a big, jacked-up guy. Obviously, he fits that mold perfectly that they're looking for. But he looks like Bautista, and that's why they put him on TV so quickly. This guy is not ready to be on TV. From what I understand, he's a smart enough guy to realize that he's not ready and that he actually, when they put the belt on him in FCW all those months ago, when he was even less experienced than he is now. And this guy used to be, you know, I don't know that he has some great wrestling background. He has a good look. He used to be, I think, on the British version of American Gladiators. That's his background, basically, in a nutshell. When they put the title on him down in developmental, he was actually opposed to it. You know, he was saying to the other wrestlers, why are they doing this? Why are they putting the title on me? I'm not ready. In fact, out of everybody here on this roster, I'm probably the worst one here. So he got an education really quick in how the wrestling business works. And he actually made some allies, I guess you would say, and that people at least looked at the guy and said, look, he's smart enough to know that he's not that great. He's smart enough to know that he's not prepared for this. He doesn't have a big ego about it. And that's what people kind of liked about him. And I think that's kind of cool, because a lot of guys in that same position would not have said the same thing. They would have just accepted it and thought that, you know, they were hot shit. So this guy, he comes on Raw, he teases attacking both guys, he kicks CM Punk in the face, which again, they never announced it, but to me that means Punk won the match by DQ. He was basically, that was his sacrifice after all the other members of Nexus were forced into these initiations last week, and Punk never really did anything to sacrifice himself. That's at least how I interpreted it. Too bad the announcers never bothered explaining any of this. Maybe they will this Monday, but at the end of the day, the guy aligned himself with Punk. He attacked John Cena, and he is the newest member of Nexus. So Slater and Gabriel, they didn't do their initiation last week. They walked out, and as we saw on SmackDown, they are now part of Wade Barrett's new crew on SmackDown with Ezekiel Jackson. They're calling themselves The Core, with two R's, mind you. I don't know why. I guess just to be different, like spelling China with a Y. I had one reader write into to me this week and just inform me that The Core, as it's spelled on WWE TV, in Spanish apparently translates into to run, basically. So I guess the name of their group, when you really spell it out, it's called The Run. There's a joke in there somewhere about the runs and how watching Ezekiel Jackson matches has sometimes given me that feeling in the past, but anyway, that's the new Nexus group on SmackDown, what they're calling themselves. So the new Nexus on Raw is now comprised of CM Punk, Mike McGillicuddy, Husky Harris, and Mason Ryan, and David Otunga, unfortunately. It was a good debut. Not the best debut I've ever seen, but he made an impact, and it was sort of left as a cliffhanger. We'll find out more about this guy, hopefully, on Raw this coming Monday night. But a good match between Punk and Cena. Hopefully it's not the last of them that we are going to see. The other thing about Raw I wanted to mention, the last point here, and it really struck me watching this show. Maybe I missed it. Maybe I was flipping channels at the end of one of the commercial breaks when they came back. But, you know, even if they were doing it on Monday, which I don't think they were, when WrestleMania comes around, in fact, we're already starting to see it. Months in advance, when WrestleMania season comes around, every single year without fail, we are treated to the same WrestleMania clips over and over again, hyping that the show is X number of days away. They give a countdown 3 months in advance that WrestleMania is coming. And we see the same highlights every single year. Hogan slamming Andre. You know, we see, Undertaker going, 8-0 at WrestleMania. We see... excuse me, highlights from some, one of the Money in the Bank ladder matches, or, you know, it's the same stuff every single year. And I know that the Rumble is not on the same level as WrestleMania, but the Royal Rumble by default, and probably in terms of buy rates, is the number two. You know, it's the de facto number two show behind WrestleMania every year, my second favorite show. If you really wanted to make the Royal Rumble feel more special, why wouldn't you treat the Rumble the way you treat WrestleMania? I'm not even saying that you need a countdown 2 months in advance for the Royal Rumble. But why am I not watching WWE television every week now and seeing clips from some of the past Royal Rumble matches? Why are there no highlights being shown of, you know, Ric Flair throwing sit-out to win the 92 Rumble, of Bret Hart and Lex Luger tumbling over the top rope in 94, of Shawn Michaels, and they have shown clips of this, Shawn Michaels holding on and, you know, being number one and going on to win the Rumble in 95. Steve Austin throwing up Bret Hart to win the Rumble in 97, and so on and so forth. They will show Rumble highlights occasionally, and I know they put that video package together with the Rumble statistics, which I like. It's a cool video. But, I mean, goddamn, they shove WrestleMania down our throats every single year with these highlights and, you know, the WrestleMania Rewind. They should do the same thing with the Rumble and remind people that the Rumble match is exciting, that the Rumble match is important, that anything can happen, that there have been some exciting finishes to a lot of these Rumble matches in the past. I don't think they do a good enough job of hyping the Rumble match, because just by showing those videos, you could probably convince some people to buy these pay-per-views, these Rumble pay-per-views, who maybe have given up on it. Because clearly, you don't have as many people... purchasing the Royal Rumble as you once did. You know, in fact, last year's numbers were pretty fucking terrible. And like I said, I'm buying the pay-per-view no matter what, so from a personal perspective, it's not a big deal, but the Rumble that is not feeling as special to me as it maybe should. And I think doing something like that the way they do it for WrestleMania would go a long way. I'm not sure why they're not doing it, and I think they should. And you know, it's interesting. I read this past week something that I was actually not aware of. You know, here I am, as many of you, I'm sure, thinking that the very first Royal Rumble with that name was held in 1988, which, you know, there was a Rumble show in 88 in Canada. It actually aired as a free network special on USA. Popped over an 8 rating, which I believe is still the highest rated wrestling show ever on USA Network. And back then, the Rumble was 20 men. I think the following year, it went to 30. Anyway, Hacksaw Jim Duggan won the Rumble in 88. And here I am thinking that Hacksaw Jim Duggan was the very first Royal Rumble winner, but apparently not. Apparently, the first Royal Rumble was actually held with that name the year before. And actually, it wasn't even the year before. It was only a couple of months before, in October of 1987. In St. Louis, Missouri, it did very poorly. I don't even think they had 2,000 fans in the building. And the one-man gang was the winner of the Royal Rumble. Apparently, WWE has all but erased this Rumble match from history. And it wasn't until I read that this past week that I even realized there was a Rumble in 1987. So, technically, the one-man gang was actually the very first Royal Rumble winner. But WWE, I guess, simply does not acknowledge that. Jeff Hardy was back in court this past week, or at least his lawyer was. I don't know if Jeff was there physically himself. And all we've been hearing the last couple of weeks is that January 20th is finally going to be the day. No more continuances, no more delays. They've reached some sort of plea agreement. Jeff is going to plead guilty to at least one of the charges against him, and we're finally going to begin to put this bullshit behind us. And apparently that is not exactly what happened. Jeff already got yet another fucking continuance on his drug trafficking case. He'll be back in court on February 16th. And at this point, I'm convinced that no matter what date they give, this guy is going to be on trial for the rest of his life. He'll be an old, withered, crippled old man at the age of 48. And he'll still be hung up on charges from 2008. Is that when? Was it 2000? No, 2009, I believe, is when the raid on his home occurred. 2009. It's 2011. And there's still continuances in this. Apparently, both sides had agreed to some sort of plea, and one or both sides must have changed their mind. I don't know who it was. I don't know if it was the prosecution, if it was the defense. My guess, and from what I read from some of the news articles, and nobody knows for sure at this point, but it sounds as though the defense was not getting the type of plea bargain they were hoping for. And so they're kind of going back to the well to do some more negotiating. I understand that you're innocent until proven guilty. And I've actually had a few people write in who have been, you know, hit by charges not all that dissimilar from the ones that Jeff Hardy is dealing with. And they've explained that it's not as cut and dry as it sounds. Jeff and his brother have claimed, or at least Matt Hardy has claimed, that it was a setup. He didn't do anything wrong. Eventually the truth will come out. And it could very well be true, these people say. So, I'm not going to throw Jeff Hardy under the bus just yet. But the fact is this. Jeff Hardy has a history. Okay? And that history has shaped people's perceptions of him, for better or worse. Now, this guy has numerous drug charges against him. Not just one drug charge. Numerous drug charges. Now, do I believe he was trafficking? I don't know. I would tend to think he probably was using and not trafficking. But I don't know that for sure. These Hardy guys are fucking crazy. It must be something in the water in North Carolina. I don't know what these guys are capable of. Maybe they were. They certainly have not made themselves look good through all these YouTube videos that we've seen over the last couple of months. They've done themselves no favors. So, the most serious charges are the ones that include trafficking. And maybe there's a hang-up on that. But the fact is, the guy has a history here. And he was hit with all of these drug charges. And I just can't help but think that, you know, anybody else in the same position would not be as fortunate as Jeff Hardy has been. Maybe he has a really good lawyer. Maybe he's just been lucky. Maybe the prosecution are a bunch of bumbling fools. All I know is, it's an important story. you know, all the wrestling news sites cover it and whatnot, because here's Jeff Hardy, a former WWE champion, the guy that was just holding the TNA world title before they took it off him, you know, with all of these major felony drug charges facing him. But I'm so tired of this story. I'm so tired of Jeff Hardy getting another continuance and another continuance. Either let the guy go and just wipe out all the charges, or throw him in the fucking slammer and just be done with it. I mean, really, every single month he gets a continuance here. If I were Jeff Hardy, I would want to just get this taken care of already so I don't have to worry about it anymore. But he just keeps getting delay after delay, you know, and now, you know, TNA has a pretty big taping that you know, the February 3rd Impact is a pretty big show for TNA. And there's been some talk that perhaps they might even put the belt back on Jeff Hardy, which sounds like something TNA would probably do. But it kind of keeps them in limbo, too, because they don't know what Jeff Hardy's fate is going to hold. And he's one of their biggest stars. So TNA is kind of in a rut right now, because what are they supposed to do? They can't put the belt back on the guy. If they do, which, like I said, I guess they could, but it ain't going to make them look too good if they do that. What do you do with the guy? You know, this keeps getting delayed and delayed and delayed. It kind of fucks over TNA in a way, too. So anyway, that was the Jeff Hardy story this past week. He gets another break. And how this is going to end, I just have no idea. It would be kind of funny if he actually was found guilty on all the charges and they said, fuck it, we're not negotiating with this guy. Throw him in there and lock him up and throw away the key for the next 20 years. And, well, let's just hope that doesn't happen. Now, I saw on Facebook where some people are still talking about this essentially non-story, but they want me to comment on it. So the whole Kurt Angle blading himself at the Genesis pay-per-view and doing this backstage interview before his match or his exhibition, I suppose, with Jeff Jarrett, where he seemed a little out of it, maybe under the influence of something. So I've seen the blade job. It was pretty apparent, you know. And I've seen guys who blade themselves and you know, it's kind of obvious what they're doing, and this was maybe one of the most egregious examples I've ever seen. Not the worst, but it was obvious that Kurt Angle was cutting himself open during his match. And I went and I saw the interview for the first time that he did with Christy Hemme backstage before the match. Now, does Angle look like he might be under the influence of something? Perhaps. He also could be very tired. I've seen Kurt Angle speak. I've seen Kurt Angle interviews. I've seen Kurt Angle in person. I've met the guy several years ago at a TNA show here in New York. And the thing about Kurt Angle that concerns me, and this has been the way for years, and he seems to be a fully functioning adult. I mean, he's still well-spoken in most interviews that he's in, and he can go in there and have a five-star match with just about anybody. But he always has this glassy-eyed look. You know, he's got this look like his eyes are glazed over all the time. And that always freaked me out about Kurt Angle. And even when I met him, he had that same look in his eyes. Like, he's not all there. That's just who Kurt Angle is. You know, maybe he used to have painkiller addictions that he actually talked about. And he likes to say that he's clean. He quit cold turkey. He didn't need rehab or anything. I find that incredibly difficult to believe. Especially with a guy probably as beat up as Kurt Angle is. But nonetheless, that's what he claims. Does he have a drug problem? Who knows? TNA doesn't have a wellness program the likes that WWE has. And keep in mind, Kurt Angle is not with WWE, in large part because of those issues. And because WWE implemented such a powerful program, which, for all the loopholes that still may be there, is still far, far more advanced than any drug policy they've ever had before. And it's telling that Kurt Angle left the company around the same time, or within a matter of months, that the wellness policy was officially instituted. And Kurt Angle, in the 5 or 6 years since then, has not returned to WWE. And I'm not saying it's just because of their drug policy, but I find it telling. I would have expected by now that Kurt would be back in WWE. And I know he teased it before re-signing with TNA. I just wonder how much of a factor that does play into that. I wonder if Kurt Angle is being completely forthcoming when he says that all those issues he had in the past are behind him. The interview that I saw from Genesis, it didn't make him look good. He looked pretty out of it the first, like, 10 seconds of the interview, but then he kind of rebounded. He cut a promo that didn't seem anywhere out of the ordinary, and he walked off. And again, the guy goes out there, he performs, like he always has. You know, it's not like he's out there stumbling around, forgetting spots, looking all inebriated, you know, like Jake Roberts on the indie scene or anything like that, or, you know, Scott Hall. You know, the guy, he's a machine. He goes in there, he still has, like I said, 4 5-star matches. But I don't know. I watched that interview, and I think people are making a bigger deal out of it than they need to. You know, he sounded a little weird the first few seconds, and then after that, he sounded fine. I've heard worse from Kurt Angle. I wouldn't make a big stink about it. You know, Kurt's fine. Except for that whole, you know, glassy-eyed look. Last thing I wanted to mention here before we get into all the monstrous feedback that we have this week is something that I honestly didn't even realize was kind of significant about this past week or this month. And I read it, it was one of the cover stories in the most recent edition of Dave Meltzer's Wrestling Observer newsletter, and I think it's worth mentioning here. The monumental nature of some things that happened this month 10 years ago, a decade it's been. And the fact that these three things happened all within the time span of really a matter of days of each other is quite mind-boggling looking back at it, you know, with the benefit of hindsight. And it was 10 years ago this month, again, all right around the same, within the same week virtually, that there was a press conference held to announce that Fusion Media and Eric Bischoff were going to be taking over as the new owners and operators of World Championship Wrestling from Time Warner. Again, this was when Bischoff himself thought that he had wrestled control of WCW away from the big media conglomerate, and he, Bischoff, was going to be, I believe, the president and creative head of the new WCW. Of course, as we all know, this ended up not happening. Lots of things were going on behind the scenes. They actually did have a press conference to announce this. This really happened. And this was around the time that the AOL-Time Warner merger, I guess, had finally officially gone through. There were people looking at the books. WCW had been performing so horribly. They had lost so much money and were so deep in the red. There were people who just could not wait to unload WCW. And then there was somebody by the name of Jamie Kellner, who kind of took over programming for Time Warner. And Jamie Kellner hated professional wrestling, whereas Ted Turner embraced it because really Ted Turner realized that wrestling was the saving grace of his early superstation in the 80s. And he had a soft spot for pro wrestling because of that. And that's why it was a staple on TBS and later TNT for many years in the 80s into the 90s, you know, when Nitro became big. And Jamie Kellner did not feel nearly as warm and fuzzy about pro wrestling. He hated it, and he wanted it off the network. You know, they wanted TNT to branch out into more upscale programming and television dramas, and he did not see wrestling being part of the whole package. He just didn't want it. So he pulled the plug, and he basically took away all of WCW's TV, or at least from TNT, but I think it was TNT and TBS. They basically took away the TV deal that WCW had in place. And what ended up happening at that point is, you know, had Bischoff taken over WCW, he no longer had any TV. Without TV, WCW was virtually worthless to him. Couldn't survive. And to make a new TV deal, if it would have been possible, would have taken some time. Now, there have been people that have worked for Time Warner since then who apparently have said that Bischoff was never going to really own WCW, that press conference, they really jumped the gun. There was no official deal in place. So who knows? You know, the truth probably lies somewhere in the middle. But the fact is, for a certain period of time, you know, in January of 01, many people, including Bischoff himself, believed that he had taken over WCW and was going to be able to just operate it as he saw fit and was going to take it in a new direction and revive the company. You know, there would be a blackout period maybe of 2 months where they can regroup and come up with new creative, and they were going to relaunch WCW bigger and better than ever. And Bischoff, when he found out those TV spots were no longer available, was probably pretty depressed about it. And he realized at that point that any potential deal was basically dead. Of course, we all know what ended up happening. Vince McMahon swooped in and basically bought WCW for a meager $2.5 million. And what he bought for that $2.5 million was essentially a couple of contracts for some of the mid-card guys, the trademarks and rights to a lot of the pay-per-view titles and show titles, and of course, perhaps the biggest asset above all else, the video library. And little could they have known in 2001 even, when they were doing DVDs, how valuable that library would be to them years later with their on-demand channel. Of course, WWE is looking to launch their own 24-hour cable network within the next 2 years. That tape library was the biggest asset they swooped in, and they basically got it for $2.5 million. Whereas Bischoff, when he either made the deal or thought he was going to be making the deal to buy WCW, I've heard figures as high as $75 million that he and his partners were going to buy the company for. Vince McMahon got it for $2.5. And this is a company, mind you, that had been in the black, grossing tens upon tens of millions of dollars just a few years earlier. And this is what it had come to. WCW was sold off for pennies to the competition. So that would have been on January 11th, 2001. Now, within a matter of hours, there was another big story taking place that involved the UFC. UFC was popular, but obviously not nearly as popular as it would become later on. And the problem for UFC is it just never caught on because it was still banned in many states. And it was banned, I think, even from pay-per-view. John McCain, who ran for president here in the U.S. in 2008, was a noted opponent of the UFC. They had a lot of enemies that they had made. And Bob Myrowitz and the owners of UFC reached that point where as much as they wanted it to be a success and they believed in the concept, they simply could not sustain it anymore. And they sold 100% of the company for $2 million to a new company called Zuffa, which was owned by the Fertitta brothers. And Dana White, who at the time was actually a manager for Tito Ortiz, was the man who was basically hired to run the company and be the president of the UFC. This shy, bald young guy who had managed, at least, you know, who had managed fighters before, was brought in to run UFC. And obviously, when they came up with their Ultimate Fighter reality show concept years later, and they were able to get that on Spike TV and find a national cable outlet, their fortunes turned around. Nobody could have expected UFC to take off the way that it has. Nobody could have expected that UFC would survive, let alone survive long enough to now dominate WWE, the worldwide renowned pay-per-view leader for years and years. And now WWE is kind of looking in the rearview mirror at nobody, because UFC is far in front of them. And not many people would have predicted that that would have happened. Again, here's a company that was on the verge of death. And the owners sold it for $2 million. Pennies. And the Fertitta brothers and Dana White turned it around into a multi-million dollar venture. To the point where if UFC were to be sold now, here's a company that could probably fetch in the hundreds of millions of dollars. And again, this happened right around the same time that that stuff was happening with WCW. Fast forward 2 days. January 13th, 2001. Pine Bluff, Arkansas was the site of what would go on to be, as it turned out, the final official ECW event. It was an ECW house show, the original ECW. And there was a lot of uncertainty at that time. Because, of course, ECW had been kicked off TNN. They had lost their TV deal when TNN decided to get into bed a couple of months earlier with WWE, who had left the USA Network at the time. And ECW was deeply in debt. Not as much as WCW or even UFC, which I think, you know, also had been losing tens of millions of dollars at the time. But ECW was in bad shape. But many of the guys on the roster believed that Paul Heyman was going to pull a rabbit out of the hat. You know, Paul Heyman had, you know, a lot of people drinking the Kool-Aid. And he was a great master motivator. Not necessarily a great businessman, but a great motivator, a great creative person. And people believed that there was some sort of deal in the works. Heyman was going to work his magic, and ECW was going to live on. For how long, nobody knew. As it turned out, that turned out to be the last show. And Heyman kind of disappeared. Nobody was able to get in touch with him. Nobody knew what was going on. It was the beginning of March. And mind you, ECW was still scheduled for a pay-per-view, I believe, in March of 01. and a lot of the boys didn't believe it was going to happen. A lot of them did believe that Paul was going to work his magic. They'd have their pay-per-view as scheduled, and things were going to turn around. And then they saw Paul Heyman pop up one day on Monday Night Raw, sitting next to Jim Ross as an announcer. This would have been when Jerry Lawler quit the company, and they needed somebody new, and Heyman struck a deal to be an announcer with WWE. There were a lot of people who worked for ECW who didn't necessarily look at this and think that Heyman had stabbed them in the back. They figured, well, this must be part of a bigger deal that Heyman reached with WWE. After all, WWE and ECW had a secret working agreement with each other in the mid-90s. You know, Vince McMahon, it would come out later, was helping to finance and subsidize Extreme Championship Wrestling. As it turned out, that was not the case. ECW was dead. Paul Heyman knew it. Apparently didn't have the guts to even just tell his employees that it was over. He kind of let them dangle and figure it out for themselves. Not the classiest move on his part. And struck a deal on his own with WWE to be their lead announcer. Now, of course, since that time, we've seen a lot of different iterations of the original ECW. None as good as the original, if you were a fan of that. But that was January 13th, 01. The final real ECW show took place in Pine Bluff, Arkansas, and the company, for all intents and purposes, died at that point. WCW died around the same time ECW died. UFC got sold off to new owners who, it would take a couple of years, but they were able to turn the company around. All of these events happened in the time span of just a couple of days, in January of 2001. And here we are in January of 2011. And again, with the benefit of hindsight, it's just incredible to look back on what was and what might have been. You know, UFC has turned into this huge juggernaut and is the premier MMA organization in the world. In the world. ECW, as I said, there's been a lot of imitations, a lot of ECW revivals and reunion shows. The only one that I thought was actually of any great value was the first ECW One Night Stand. That was just a fun fucking pay-per-view. And that right there was the best closure you could give that company. The second One Night Stand was a good show too, but it had nothing to do with closure for the original ECW. It was meant to be a launching pad for the brand on Sci-Fi, which was a fucking complete and total failure. You know, TNA did their Hardcore Justice pay-per-view, which did a much better buy rate than TNA pay-per-views usually do. So they popped a big number, and that was about it. It pretty much fizzled out after that. And actually, most if not all, I think Tommy Dreamer is still under contract with TNA, but pretty much all the ECW guys they brought in are now gone from TNA. They either quit or were fired. And then as far as WCW, that may be the most egregious example of all. You know, the potential that that company had, even if they had started losing in the ratings war and were no longer number one, if they had pushed those younger guys that they had on that roster, if they had pushed Rey Mysterio harder than they did, if they would have given a chance to people like Chris Benoit and Eddie Guerrero and Chris Jericho, and I know they put the belt on Benoit in 2000, but that was more a gesture on their part to keep him because they knew how upset and unhappy he was. And Benoit still left because he knew. He knew that if he stuck around, it wasn't as though they were going to, you know, not that they had to build the company around him, because to be honest with you, I wouldn't build my company around Chris Benoit either. As great a competitor as he was at the time, you don't build a company around Benoit. You make Benoit one of your staples. You make Benoit one of your top guys. You could put the belt on Benoit. You don't have to build a company around him. You build a company around guys like him and Eddie Guerrero and Chris Jericho mixed in with some of the older veteran talent. I'm not saying they should have gotten rid of Hulk Hogan, Kevin Nash, Scott Hall, and all those guys, just gotten rid of them. But if they would have done what WWE was doing well at the time, which was mix those top guys in with these younger guys and start pushing those younger guys and start making them main eventers, WCW would have been a lot better off. And I really honestly believe that WCW would still be alive today. Whether Time Warner was still owning it, if Eric Bischoff owned it, you know, Vince McMahon bought it, and Vince McMahon had his plans were to run WCW as a separate entity. That was the plan. They were having meetings on a weekly basis, Vince McMahon and Jim Ross and all the executives. They had rosters in place. They knew who was going to be on the WCW roster. They knew the plan was actually for WCW to take over the Raw time slot on Monday nights and turn Raw to Nitro and move Raw to a different night. I mean, these were the plans that were in place. And then Booker T fought Buff Bagwell in a match on Raw in Tacoma, Washington, and everything went down the toilet. I mean, the crowd reacted so poorly to that match, and that match sucked the cock so much that that in one fell swoop, Vince McMahon decided to change all of the plans they had, and WCW essentially died. Officially died at that point. So, I thought it was, you know, important just to kind of look back on this, because I really hadn't realized that it's been 10 years since then. And not only that, but that these three very significant events all happened within the time span of a matter of days. And, my oh my, how different things might have been had a couple of things just turned out a little bit differently. And, you know, where we are today, the wrestling business obviously is not nearly as strong. Wrestling is not nearly as popular as it once was. But again, I said egregious about WCW because the biggest thing that sucks about this whole thing is that, at least here in this country, you have one place to go. I mean, if you want to be in the big time, you have one place to go. And I'm not talking TNA. And, you know, the biggest regret I think that a lot of people probably have, I mean, I'm just a fan. If I'm a wrestler, I'd probably feel that, you know, if WCW were still around and hadn't gone under and belly up, there would at least be another major organization to work for. There would be more options out there. And that's the shittiest part of it all. You know, before you had a real war between two companies where guys can jump ship back and forth. They had options. And now you really just have one monopoly. And it didn't have to be that way. But unfortunately, that's how it turned out. Quick note here, for those of you who are not friends of the Solomonster, or the Solomonster as it is, on Facebook.com/TheSolomonster. By popular request, I put up a couple of old photos of yours truly. It's in an album called The Secret Files. You have to be a friend on Facebook to see them. Some pictures of me with Vince McMahon and Shawn Michaels and Earl Hebner. And somebody did point out to me that it's a little odd that, you know, these pictures are with three of the principal people involved in the Montreal Screwjob. I've met Bret Hart before. There's no picture of me with Bret up there, but that is kind of interesting. I didn't really realize it until somebody pointed it out. But anyway, if you want to check out The Secret Files, you can friend me on Facebook and check that out. Maybe I'll post some more recent photos in the near future, but you'll have to friend me on there to see them. So I just wanted to make mention of that. Now, one other thing I did during this week was something I've only done once before. And I posted a thread for a Facebook mailbag, which, again, you have to be a friend on Facebook in order to participate in this. I've done this once before, and the reason I don't do it as often as maybe some people would like is specifically for what we're seeing here. By last check, there were over 70 posts, 60-something of which are legitimate questions in that thread. And there's just far, far, far too many questions for me to get to this week. I'm going to try to run through as many as I can. And I think what we're going to do is we're going to kind of cut this up into a couple of different segments. So I will try to get to as many of these, if not all of the questions. And so long as certain ones aren't completely outdated by the time I get to them, I'm going to basically divide this up over the next one or two episodes. So if your question from the mailbag on Facebook is not read this week, do not fret. We'll probably be read either next week or the week after. But I have to cut it up because there's just so many questions. Plus, I got some good questions in email I want to get to first before we get to the Facebook stuff. So here we go. Got a question here from Airborne. Dear Solomonster, I'm a huge fan of the podcast, have been for about 9 months. You're very informative and you know your stuff, which leads me to ask this question. I was watching SmackDown on Friday and noticed the faction that formed the Core being on the show. This made me realize that SmackDown, in its 12-year history, has not had that many factions. It has a history of countless tag teams, but not so much when it comes to stables. The only factions that come to mind are the Core and Team Angle, which of course was consisted of Kurt Angle, Shelton Benjamin, and Charlie Haas. Raw, on the other hand, has had a history of factions, including DX, Evolution, Nexus, New Nexus, and a few others. My question is, has SmackDown had only two factions in its history, or am I wrong? Well, keep in mind that SmackDown, you say in its 12-year history, SmackDown in the early years had plenty of appearances by the NWO with Hogan, Hall, and Nash. It had appearances by DX, the McMahon-Helmsley regime. But if we're talking from the brand split on, from 2002 onward, there's at least two other ones that I can think of. So you have Team Angle, you have the Core, you've also had the Family, or La Familia, as it was known as. Of course, Edge, Vicky, Chavo, I believe was part of that little group and the Edgeheads. So that was a faction that they had for some time when Edge was world champion and married, quote-unquote, to Vicky Guerrero. You also had JBL's Cabinet, which, of course, was led by JBL when he was the WWE champion. I believe Jillian Hall, in her first role, was JBL's secretary or some sort of consultant. And you also had the Bashams and Orlando Jordan as part of that group. So JBL had his cabinet. And you also had the Mexicools, who may not have been a big faction in the traditional sense, but it was still a group of three guys that came out together until they were relegated to jobber status, unfortunately. But you did have the Mexicools, which, of course, involved Juventud, Super Crazy, and Psychosis? I don't remember the third member, but anyway, those are the ones that I thought of. So that's three in addition to the ones that you mentioned. Now, maybe I'm missing another one, but those are the ones that come to mind. So yes, there have in fact been more than just those two. Luis from Illinois writes in, I've asked this question before, but it bears repeating. Should and would anyone ask Vince McMahon about his dislike for Randy Savage during the company's next stockholder conference call on February 10th? This seems like the only situation where Vince would be legally obligated to go on the record about this. First of all, Vince McMahon does not legally have to say jack shit about Randy Savage if he doesn't want to. So, you know, just because Vince is you know, holding a stockholders meeting, which, by the way, Vince was conspicuous by his absence the last time they did a meeting, so there's no guarantee he'll be at this one either. But Vince doesn't have to say word one about Randy Savage if he doesn't want to. It's not pertinent to the company's bottom line or business. It's not an important question, for example, as like if somebody were to ask Vince McMahon about the falling buy rates for his product, which does have a direct effect on their business and their bottom line. So Vince doesn't have to answer that question if he doesn't want to. I don't believe anybody has asked that question yet. They normally screen those calls, so it would be one of these situations where, if you're even able to ask the question in the first place, you can lie and say that you're going to ask about one thing and then ask about Savage instead. So if anybody's listening who is a WWE stockholder, well, February 10th, if anybody has the guts, maybe they will step up to the plate and ask Vince McMahon that question. But again, no guarantee Vince will be on the call, and even if he is, he doesn't have to give you an answer. Michael from Romania writes in, he's been a fan since episode 130, wanted to know if I would like to see another themed episode of Raw like Raw Old School, only this time with an Attitude Era theme. If you were to bring back the Attitude Era wrestlers along with the current roster, what match would you like to see in the main event of that show? I actually would not like to see that. I think Raw Old School, the way they did it last year, was fine. I would be fine if they did it that way every single year. Not that, you know, that was the only good era of WWE. The Attitude Era was a great time. But they've tried numerous times to kind of replicate the Attitude Era in recent years, and they've failed. And the biggest thing is you can never truly do a themed episode of Raw just like the Attitude Era as long as WWE is PG. You can push the boundaries a little bit. You can get a little edgy. But you can't do it the way that Attitude should be done. So why bother doing it in the first place? It's like ECW. You know, when they revived ECW years ago, if they had no intention of doing ECW the way that ECW was done originally, they never should have done it in the first place. It was a fail from the beginning, if that was their attitude about it. A lot of the Attitude Era guys are actually still with the company anyway. I mean, a guy like Edge, I guess, is more associated with the later era. I still kind of lump him into that whole Attitude Era, though. He was a tag guy more than a single star, but still. You know, Austin, Rock. Rock's not going to do it. Austin might come back and make an appearance, but he's not. What's he going to do? Undertaker is still there, although he's hurt right now. Big Show is still there. Kane is still there. What are they going to do, put the mask back on Kane for one night? Bring back Val Venus? Fuck Val Venus. I don't want to see him on TV. I don't think it's such a good idea. I think we should just preserve the memory of the Attitude Era, which, again, was not perfect. There was a lot of bullshit in the Attitude Era, just like there's bullshit in wrestling now. But I look back fondly on that time period, and I just don't see there being a really legit way for them to do a Raw show, you know, with the Attitude Era theme in an era of PG. It just wouldn't work. CJ from Buffalo writes in, your Solomon Monster was watching a Royal Rumble match from 1989 with the Hart Foundation and Hacksaw Jim Duggan against the fabulous Rougeau Brothers and Dino Bravo. This made me think about how fans today might respond to a match like this, a pay-per-view battle with a six-man tag. I personally would love to see them mix up how they do the matches on pay-per-views, or rather how the matches are produced on television, but that's my opinion. How do you think fans would react to a match like this on a current WWE pay-per-view show? Well, you know, I don't know that they would react unfavorably to it. If you've got six guys in there that they care about, or if you've got six guys in there that can bust their ass and can wrestle, I think a six-man tag match on a pay-per-view like a Royal Rumble would be a great way to get the crowd fired up at the beginning of the show. I mean, that's how they used to do it. They would have matches like that all the time. In fact, the Royal Rumble in... SummerSlam in 1989. And I'm using this because I saw this match recently and I thought it was fucking great. Was, I believe, opened with a tag title match with the Brainbusters and the Hart Foundation. And it was a great match. And it got the crowd going. And I think a big part of that was because it was such a great match leading off the show. It's kind of the, you know, Bret and Owen at WrestleMania 10. You know, they wanted to get the show off on the right foot. Plus, Bret was wrestling twice that night. But that got the pay-per-view off to a roaring start. I mean, I can give you other examples if I sat here and thought about how important opening matches can be to kind of setting the tone with a crowd on pay-per-view. Now, if your question is having six-man tags more on pay-per-view since we see them so often on free TV, it might require a little bit of an education. I could see where people would see a six-man tag on pay-per-view and think, oh, why the hell would I pay for this pay-per-view? I see six-man tags on Raw every week. But I don't have a problem with it. If you've got six guys in there that can work, you put them in there for 15 or 20 minutes and they can tear the house down with a great match, I'd love to see more of that. I think that could work. I really do. But again, part of the problem is you're looking at the Royal Rumble in 1989. And back in 1989, you didn't have Monday Night Raw. You didn't have a TV show like Raw that was putting on feature matches like this every single week. If you had primetime wrestling, you would get one feature match. You know what I mean? It was just a different time period. TV now is just so much different. It's been, I mean, think about it. It's been over 20 years since that time. It's just a very different time period. I don't know that it would work as well. You'd have to really educate, I think, the fans. And Russell in the UK writes in, Dear Solemn Monster, do you know why WWE gave away Chris Jericho against The Undertaker on SmackDown? A rare example of two legends who had never met before? A surefire WrestleMania main event? It seems completely ridiculous. Well, I don't know about surefire WrestleMania main event. I think I actually said on this podcast that Jericho and The Undertaker is a match, at that time anyway, that I really didn't have any interest in seeing at WrestleMania. Because there's no way that Jericho would be able to, as great as Chris Jericho is, there's no way I would have been able to buy the fact that he would actually beat The Undertaker. And like I said, I'm convinced that Undertaker's streak is not ending. John Cena gives people the best chance of believing that they might actually end the streak. Therefore, I think it would make for the best match. Fast forward now, it's been you know, at least a year, maybe 2 years since we saw Jericho and Undertaker that first time on SmackDown. And knowing that Undertaker, if he makes it to WrestleMania, is in for a match with either Kane again or maybe Wade Barrett or Ezekiel Jackson, it has me longing for a Chris Jericho-Undertaker match at WrestleMania, but not the main event. I don't see that as a true WrestleMania main event. Why they gave the match away, your guess is as good as mine, because they can't help themselves. They just can't help themselves. It didn't even have to be WrestleMania. I mean, that could be a great pay-per-view match on SummerSlam. You know, Royal Rumble. Why give it away on SmackDown? Don't know. But was it a stupid move? I think it was. But you know what? Jericho is out of the company now. Undertaker's... people have been saying Undertaker's career has been winding down for the last 15 years, but he's coming to the end of his rope. We probably will never have another opportunity to see a Jericho-Undertaker match, so at least I'm happy they did it. I just wish they would have done it a little bit differently. All right, so now we're going to break into the Facebook mailbag. Like I said, I'm not going to be able to get to everything this week. I'll probably get to more next week and the week after. But let's run through some of these first from Facebook. Craig Lee writes in, Do you think with WWE's main star, that being John Cena, on Raw Monday night, quote-unquote ripping the PG style, it could be on its way out in the next few years? Of course, this is in reference to Cena made a comment, one of these comedic comments on Raw. I think it was last week. He used like the word poop or something like that and said, come on, people, I'm working with PG here. I thought that was a nice little wink and a nod. It absolutely does not mean PG is on its way out. Do not read anything into it. It's not going anywhere. Cena, you know, he's under the same restrictions as everybody else. He knows it. And it is what it is. You know, he'll make little funny comments like that every now and then. It has nothing to do with PG going away. PG is here to stay. And it's just something that we're all going to have to deal with. Let's see here. Gary Thompson was wondering your thoughts on theme songs. Seems to me that not many wrestlers have classic theme songs with a good hook. More and more wrestlers these days have really bad generic rock music, R&B, or whatever. I personally think that if WWE began to use their in-house music department more, it would be beneficial for many characters on the roster. Ted DiBiase, Randy Orton, Dolph Ziggler, and Cody Rhodes are a few examples. I feel a good instrumental song could do much more than having their theme song spell out their gimmick. Been a listener since episode 99. Well, first of all, they have their own in-house music department, and it's not like they don't use them. It's just that they're taking a different approach to theme songs now. But I agree. I mean, theme songs back in the 80s and 90s were a lot more iconic for these guys than the theme songs of today, which is not to say I dislike all the theme music. I think Randy Orton's theme is pretty good. You know, I mean, I'm trying to think of some other ones, but it's kind of escaping me at the moment. I'm not really making a good argument for it here. The fact is, I can rattle off a bunch of names from the WWF in the 80s and 90s, whether it was Hulk Hogan's Real American, if it was Jive Soul Brawl by, you know, Slickster, Demolition's theme song, you know, even Ultimate Warrior. You're talking about instrumentals. Ultimate Warrior, that music fit that character to a T. Here's a guy who was fucking insane. All he would do was grunt and snort and run around like a fucking madman on a coke binge. But that music, that beat that it had, fit his character perfectly. And there were no lyrics, there were no words. They had a good guitar riff later on in the song. It was great, you know? And we don't really have that anymore. Every song, I think now, virtually every song, has lyrics. It's like real music, which is, you know, sort of like what UFC does with its fighters, and that's fine, but by no means do the theme songs of today, you know, stand as iconic as the theme songs of yesterday. Stone Cold Steve Austin, when that glass shattered, again, no words, when that glass, unless you're talking about the Disturbed version of his theme music, but going back before that, the glass shattered, and you knew shit's on. You knew who was coming out. And it was just great stuff. Theme music in wrestling today, not as good as it used to be, unfortunately. William wants to know, bigger upset, Amazing Red beating Samoa Joe for the X Division title in TNA, or Santino Marella defeating Umaga for the Intercontinental title in WWE? I'm going to go with Santino beating Umaga. That was actually a great debut. They actually showed it on 24/7 On Demand. It's on right now. And I had the opportunity to watch it for the first time probably since it happened in 2000. I guess it would have been 2007. And it's funny looking at Santino then compared to now, where he's just a complete comedy character. But he's very over. I mean, whatever they're doing with Santino now, it's working. The fans love him. He's entertaining and all that. But, you know, he wasn't pushed as a comedy character right out of the gate. You know, again, he was a fan in the audience. Raw was being taped in Italy. They were in Milan. And Vince McMahon plucked Santino out of the crowd to fight Umaga for the Intercontinental belt. And he, you know, Bobby Lashley interfered. And Santino won the Intercontinental title on Raw in his very first match. You're really going to compare Amazing Red winning the X title in TNA to that? Come on. There's no comparison. Jeremy writes in, TNA seemed to be gaining popularity on their own before they brought in Bischoff and Hogan. While excitement was there in the beginning, it's been nothing now other than a cluster of poor ideas and crappy Russo booking. Do you believe that to get back on their feet, they need to cut back on the total nonstop talking and get back to the action that originally gave them their following, coupled with them doing live Impact shows from different arenas? Your thoughts? I don't care if Impact is live or taped. As long as they get Impact out of the Impact Zone more often, I think it's a good move. They may not be able to afford it. Financially, it may not be such a good move, but I think Spike is actually, because it was a Spike TV idea for TNA to start taping Impact on the road on certain occasions, and they're kicking in at least some of the money. They're taking care of some of the expenses, which, if that's the case, that's fine. And I know there's been plenty of wrestling companies over the years, going back even to the 60s and 70s, who had plenty of success running the same fucking building every single week. But TNA is not those companies. And again, that was 30, 40 years ago. 20, 30 years ago. It's a different time. And you know what? Maybe it's not even that. I take that back. You know, I think of TNA and the product that they could be putting on, and the product they are putting on, and the product they're putting on, for the most part, with a few exceptions, is garbage. And when you keep giving the same people in the same building the same garbage week after week, that's what really, I think, turns them off. So TNA can go on the road and give garbage to a new audience, and the same thing will end up happening. It's got to be, like you said, yes, cut back on the total nonstop talking. Give us more action that TNA was known for in the beginning. They are going to be placing, supposedly, an emphasis again soon on the X Division, which is good. It's a good start. I'll believe it when I see it. But if they start doing more things like that and taking Impact on the road and start building up some goodwill with new crowds, that might be the best thing for them to do. I just don't have the confidence that they're actually going to stick to it. AJ writes in, with the creation of the Core on SmackDown, do you feel as if WWE is setting up a storyline where Nexus and the Core will feud, or do you think that they will be the two groups, they will keep the two groups, rather, separate? Right now, there's going to be no such feud. Who's to say that if these two groups are still going strong in 3 or 4 months after WrestleMania, they could do it? All I know is that leading into WrestleMania, there will be no such confrontation between the two groups, so no. Jason wants to know, do you think FCW should be shown on WWE's site? No, I don't. What I think they should probably do, I believe they own the OVW tape library. What I would love to see them do is start airing some of that OVW footage on their 24/7 on-demand channel, is what I would like to see. And eventually, when they have their own TV network, migrate that content over there as well. There's a minefield of great content from the old Ohio Valley wrestling days. And especially when Paul Heyman was booking. And I would love to see that stuff on TV, because I don't live in Louisville, and I'm not like a tape trader or anything, so I've never really had an opportunity to see it. And I think that that's some stuff that they need to start getting on the air, and on demand, it would seem would be the best place to put that stuff. As far as FCW, you know, they have a TV show locally in Florida, and the object is you want to keep these guys off TV nationally until they're ready. You don't want to expose these guys to a national TV audience when, you know, at some point, these are the guys probably with different names and different gimmicks later on that are going to be on TV. So you kind of keep it on the low profile, if you will, until these guys are ready to be on TV. Unfortunately, they're moving a lot of these guys to TV anyway before they're ready, so probably doesn't make a difference. Corey writes in, what are your thoughts on CZW? That, of course, would be Combat Zone Wrestling here in the Northeast. I'm not talking about the fat old guys hitting each other with light tubes. Mention them if you want to. But I'm talking rather about the other part of CZW with actual wrestling. They seem to put on some of the best matches around, apart maybe from ROH, and deserve credit for making CZW what it is, apart, again, from those old fat guys hitting each other with weapons, which is what CZW, in some respects, has come to be known for. This comes from Corey in Australia. I am not all that familiar with CZW. I'm aware of them. I've seen clips of matches from CZW on YouTube, and you're right. When I see clips of matches and the matches that get the most views, it's the matches with light tubes and glass and just stupid weapons. And I'm not into that at all. I know some people are. It takes even what the old ECW did to a new level. Think about that. I'm not into that at all. Seeing guys mutilate themselves for the sake of mutilating themselves and doing it in front of 50 people, that's not my idea of wrestling. I'm a wrestling fan. I'm not a hardcore light tube fan. So no, I'm not into that bullshit. Now, CZW does have real wrestling matches aside from that. I just can't comment on it because I'm not that familiar with the product. I'm sure they put on some great matches. I'm just saying it's unfortunate that a lot of that gets overshadowed by their reputation for putting on matches that have all the crap in it. I know that, for example, guys like Chris Hero and I believe Claudio Castagnoli, who now are the best tag team in all of wrestling, in my opinion, and are in Ring of Honor. And Chris Hero, for sure, I know that he either came from or passed through CZW first before coming to ROH and becoming a bigger star. In that respect, I'm sure there's been a lot of great talent that's come through CZW, a lot of great independent talent who didn't necessarily participate in matches like that. They went into CZW, had great matches, and moved on. So I'm not going to say bad things about the group. I'm just not into a lot of the hardcore bullshit that they've become known for. Nick says that most of the people that bash John Cena because he, quote, can't wrestle are idiots. Don't you think people need to stop hating John Cena? He's improved a lot over the past few years. You can dislike a guy's character, but all these people that come online and bitch about Cena winning the title and the 10-year-olds in the crowd just make me sick. They do it so much that it makes them sound like smarks that are stuck in the year 2006. What are your thoughts? Well, people who still bitch that John Cena can't wrestle, I admit it's an old argument. You know, Cena is not the best wrestler in the world, but neither was Hulk Hogan. And Cena, for all intents and purposes, has become the Hulk Hogan of his generation. He is that top guy. He is the guy that all the little kids are into, that they look up to. He sells the most merchandise. He is the face of that company. You know, more so than Edge and Triple H and Randy Orton and even Mysterio, who's not too far behind. Cena is that guy. And he works very, very hard. He's on the road a lot. He's had some pretty great matches, too, with a lot of different opponents. I mean, look at the last couple of years. I mean, he's had great matches with guys from Umaga to Shawn Michaels to Triple H to Edge, Randy Orton. He had a pretty good match with CM Punk on Raw Monday night. And it takes two to tango. Punk is great, but it takes two people in there to put on a great match. And for all the crap that people talk about John Cena, yes, he's not the second coming of Bret Hart, but he's not as bad as people paint him out to be. Now, his promos, on the other hand, are fucking atrocious 7 times out of 10. And again, I will lay some of that blame on him, because some of the bullshit they give him to read, if it's that bad, just don't do it. I mean, really, what the hell are they going to do to John Cena if they hand him a meaningless promo one night for Raw, and he says, you know what, this sucks. I'm going to go out there and I'm going to wing it. I'll take the bullet points, I'll do it the way that I want to do it, and just leave me alone. I mean, really, what would they do to John Cena? He's too valuable for them to suspend over something like that. I mean, the poor guy, you know, there was some talk when he got hurt at that house show a couple of weeks ago that he might be out for a long time. You know, as it turned out, he suffered a hip injury, a bruise that wasn't as bad, but WWE couldn't wait to rush him back and get him back on the road, because just him missing house shows, I mean, people, little kids will pay money to go to the house shows to see John Cena, and just him not being there posed a very big problem for WWE, to the point where I think they actually were offering refunds for some of the shows. So I do lay some of that blame at his feet, even though it's just bad material that he's working with. As a promo, not good. He can be the best promo in the company, but he's not. As a wrestler, I agree. People need to just keep their mouth shut. It's old at this point. You know, we know he's not the best wrestler in the world. So what? Get over it. There's other things to complain about. Emin Rogers leaves a very succinct message here. Steve Blackman, greatest wrestler ever or greatest wrestler ever? I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that he's the greatest wrestler ever. And his theme music was pretty good, too. Cesar writes in, is there a possibility that we could ever see John Cena, or rather John Morrison, I should say, versus Shawn Michaels at WrestleMania? I think this match could top Undertaker against Shawn Michaels. Well, sorry to say that I think we missed the boat on that match. That will definitely not be happening. Robert wants to know, if WWE has Macho Man Randy Savage in the Hall of Fame this year, would that not be kind of like a slap in the face to all of his fans, seeing as how it's going to be based mostly around Shawn Michaels? And if he is who they would consider most to hold on a second here. If he is who they most consider to induct him, seeing how Hogan was probably his best friend and Elizabeth is gone, the only other person I can see inducting Savage would be Ricky Steamboat. What are your thoughts? You know what? At this point, I would just be glad to see Macho Man go in, whether he's the headliner or not. He certainly deserves to be the headliner for a class, maybe in 2012, perhaps. But if they were to somehow come to their senses and wanted there to, you know, almost be like a double main event at the Hall of Fame this year, and they won't, because Shawn Michaels is the top guy. But if they were to put Savage in the class of 2011, I would be just as happy as I would if they wanted to put him in next year. He deserves to be in there. I think he should go in with Elizabeth. They should induct the two of them together, even though she's no longer with us, because she was so synonymous with his career and his success. She was very instrumental in many of his angles and storylines being successful in the 80s. As far as who would induct Savage, you know, most likely they would probably just take one of the current WWE guys, maybe one of the young guys, and just have them do the induction. Hogan certainly is not going to do it. I mean, Savage wouldn't want him to. I mean, it's like oil and water with those two guys. And Steamboat would be, you know what, Steamboat is not a bad choice. And he currently works for WWE, so I could see that happening, but I could just as easily see them just having somebody else do it. I mean, I know he was actually really good friends with Bryan Adams, better known as Crush. Unfortunately, he died. So I can't think of anybody else, any close friends or anybody that would be synonymous with Savage's career. So Steamboat would be a pretty good choice. Sky wants to know, do I remember the 40-man Battle Royal that took place in 1992? Also, who won it and why did it happen only once? Well, I talked about this a little earlier. It happened in 92, and Tatanka, I believe, I should know this because I've watched it, Tatanka was the winner. As far as why it only happened once, I don't know for sure. My guess would be that, again, they just realized that, and that was a Battle Royal, which is a little bit different from the rules of a Royal Rumble. It might work better this year just because you'll have some space between the guys. When you take 40 guys and stick them all in the ring at one time, you can't move. You can't do anything, and it's even more dangerous than usual because you've got fists flying, and everybody is so densely packed in. It just, visually, it looks a little impressive to see that many guys in the ring at once. Once the action gets started, if I remember correctly, you know, in watching it, it wasn't all that impressive. You were just waiting for guys to start getting thrown out because if you're going to put them all in one ring, as big as the WWE rings are, there's just not enough room. So my guess is that's why they never went back and did it again. Simon asks, how come we don't see low blows anymore in WWE? Well, I would love to see a study conducted to see if the ratio of low blows in WWE began to significantly decrease when Ric Flair retired. I would imagine there's some sort of correlation there. That guy did like 5 low blows in every single match. He probably accounted for 85% of them when he was still wrestling in WWE. Edgar writes in, Triple H recently had an interview and mentioned that he feels he's reached the point in his career where he doesn't need a championship to be a top guy. I personally feel he reached that point 5 title reigns ago, but that's just me. My question is, who in the company today do you feel has reached that stage as well? And also, since I'm speaking of Triple H, if you were booking his return, how would you do it? I certainly doubt that you would have him return to win the Royal Rumble. Well, I wouldn't have him win the Rumble, absolutely not. I would book him to return at the Rumble and probably eliminate Sheamus. Maybe the two of them eliminate one another. That's how I would book that. As far as top guys who don't necessarily need to win the championship, Triple H is at that point for sure. Undertaker is another one who's at that point. Kane, who did enjoy a title reign recently, I feel is also another one of those guys. Even Big Show. I'll put Big Show in there. Big Show doesn't need to be champion. John Cena, you know, Triple H made a comment during that same interview where he said Cena will be at that point himself eventually. I think Cena's already at that point. You know, Cena's been at, what, a 9-time champion, 10-time champion? Cena right now is involved in probably the biggest feud in WWE. It's bigger than the title feud between The Miz and Randy Orton is this John Cena CM Punk storyline, and there's no title involved. John Cena has already reached that point. Randy Orton has not. John Cena has. And I think, you know, he, like I said, Kane and Big Show, I feel, are also at that level. But if I had to pick one of the other guys, the slightly younger guys, main event guys, John Cena would be that guy. He does not need a championship to be successful. He does not need a championship to bring people into the buildings. The kids and whatnot will come just by virtue of him being at those house shows. And like I said, the top feud on the flagship show does not involve the title, but it does involve John Cena. Prince wanted to know what happened to Andrew Jackson, and unfortunately I had to let him down easily by letting him know that he died in 1845. Now, of course, if you're referring to Jackson Andrews, who is the former bodyguard of Tyson Kidd, as I mentioned in the most recent SE Scoops mailbag on the main page of the site, that mailbag went up on Friday, by the way. You should go back and check it out. He was sent back down to developmental. He was not fired, at least not yet. They realized, once he was on TV, that he was not ready. I love how they waited until he was already on TV before they realized that this guy should not be on TV, and then they simply sent him back down, and you know, sucks for him, but it sucks even more for Tyson Kidd, who had something and now has nothing. And he has officially been relegated to jobber status. So, sucks even worse to be him. Daryl wants to know, why do you think the creative team is dangling major victories in front of John Morrison just to have him lose? Are they giving him a Jeff Hardy main event build, do you think? I don't see why they're dangling... You're saying they're dangling wins only for him to lose. He lost to The Miz. True. Although I thought he gained a lot more than he lost by losing that match. I thought he looked fine in defeat. Other than that, I don't really know what you're talking about. He actually beat Daniel Bryan on Raw this past Monday night, the U.S. champion. Go back before that, he beat Sheamus. He's actually beaten Sheamus clean a couple of different times now. The same Sheamus that won King of the Ring and is likely going to be programmed with Triple H upon his return. I think, you know, between that and the video they put together for Morrison on Raw this past week, I think it was, I think they're putting the engine behind him. I don't really see where they're pulling the rug out from underneath the guy. He's got to work on his promos. I've said this before, and some people have taken offense, but the truth hurts. He's not the worst promo in the company, but for a guy they're trying to push as a top guy, he's got to get better on the microphone. I mean, he's awful. He's terrible, which is amazing because I can't really think of another guy currently on the WWE roster who was being pushed as hard as he is now and is as talented as he is inside that ring, but is so much the opposite on the microphone. And you could be the best worker in the world, but again, in today's day and age, if you can't cut it on the stick, as they say, you're not going to get pushed as a main event level guy. That's about the only thing I think that's holding Morrison back, but they seem to be doing everything else in their power to get him over. Like I said, he's got clean wins over Daniel Bryan, over Sheamus. I find that to be more surprising than anything else. And, you know, they're putting the video packages together for him, and they're really trying. I don't see them dangling shit in front of him and taking it away. I don't look at it like that. Matthew wanted to know, when Vince bought WCW, why didn't he keep both companies going? I'm thinking he would have made more money that way. I already answered this earlier in the show. Rob wants to know, which do you prefer, the Nexus on Raw or the Core on SmackDown? Well, the Core is still very new, and Nexus itself is kind of played out, but I think CM Punk has breathed some new life into it. Now you got Mason Ryan. I'm more interested and excited by the new Nexus on Raw, I would say, of the two. Stewart has two questions here. Why do you think WWE chose The Rock to battle Hulk Hogan at WrestleMania 18 instead of Stone Cold? Well, I'll answer that one first. Actually, if you, again, check out the latest SC Scoops mailbag on the main page. I think I answered this exact question this week. And if you missed it, that's fine. But go back there and read that as well. The basic reason is that Austin did not want to work with Hogan. He still harbored some ill will towards Hogan for basically what he feels sabotaging his potential push in WCW in the mid-90s, which led to Austin departing the company. Although the way things turned out for Steve, I don't think he should probably be thanking Hulk Hogan and not hating on him, which I don't think he does anymore. But at the time, he just did not want to work with Hogan. And I wonder if part of that might have been because knowing that they were going to be doing Mania at the Sky Dome in Toronto, Hogan had a huge Canadian following. And I don't even know that they expected the reaction to Hogan to be as strong as it was that night and for the people to be booing The Rock. For Austin to have been in the same position, I think he would have been a lot more upset than The Rock was. If The Rock was even upset. I mean, The Rock played that role perfectly in that match. It was almost like he was playing subtle heel, you know, like he adjusted midway through the match. I don't know that Austin would have been able to do the same thing. And I don't know that Austin and WWE wanted him to be potentially booed. But Austin, at the end of the day, just did not want to work with Hogan, so Rock got the spot. And the second part of Stewart's question here, watching WrestleMania 17 and was wondering, why did they wait until just a few moments before the main event to announce that it would be a no-disqualification match? Well, the reason they did that was it played into the storyline that would unfold later on where Steve Austin turned heel. You know, obviously that was the big swerve, the big secret at the end that Austin was going to go heel and align himself with Vince McMahon. So if you connect the dots here, in theory, the match was made no DQ, presumably at the behest of Vince McMahon prior to the match, because Austin knew that he wanted every advantage in this match. He would do whatever it takes, which, as it turned out, meant obliterating The Rock with a steel chair, which had it not been a no DQ match, would not have been allowed. So it played into the whole deception and the plan that Austin and McMahon had in place before the match. So that's why they did that. Cathal seems to think that John Morrison has the best shot of winning Money in the Bank at WrestleMania this year. What do you think? Well, if they do Money in the Bank, it's not confirmed that they're going to do another Money in the Bank ladder match at Mania, because they have a Money in the Bank pay-per-view already. It's just complete overkill. But if they do it, again, not even knowing who would be in it, I would think that John Morrison is probably in the Jeff Hardy slot of a couple of years ago, when Jeff Hardy was going to win Money in the Bank. And this would have been back in actually 08. I was at that Royal Rumble where Jeff Hardy had that match with Randy Orton and had so much momentum going into that match. And that Rumble pay-per-view did so well. It did like 450,000 buys on pay-per-view. And again, in more recent years, it's domestically, it's done like 200,000. But the reason it did so well and that match and that pay-per-view had so much behind it was because people wanted to see Jeff Hardy fight for the title, and they wanted to see him win. And WWE could have taken a chance and put the belt on Jeff Hardy if they wanted to, and they didn't. As it turned out, they made the right decision, because you may recall Jeff Hardy was suspended a couple of weeks before WrestleMania on a wellness policy violation and missed the show. And he was supposed to win Money in the Bank on the show that year. So, but it was one of those foregone conclusions. So not to say that Sean Morrison is going to fail, you know, a wellness policy test, but nor is it a foregone conclusion, but he is the favorite. If he is in the Money in the Bank match, he would have to be the favorite going into it, and he would be my pick. Luis says, or asks rather, would the most effective weapon in a fight with Vince McMahon, kayfabe or not, be Pepper, as he apparently hates sneezing? I would think just the opposite. I would think that Pepper making him sneeze would just piss him off even more, and he'd probably pound me into the ground. You won't find too many 65-year-olds in as good a shape as Vince McMahon. The last thing I want to do is get him mad. I see Mr. Turner here left a message, wants to know, who are the top three wrestlers that I mark for? Well, I don't mark. So there you go. Taylor has a message here. Solomonster, what was your favorite wrestling moment of the past decade? Wow, that's a loaded question right there. You know what? If I had some more time to really sit down and think about this, I'd probably be able to come up with a couple of different ones. But off the top of my head, there's two that come into mind, and it's from the last 2 years. The first one, I'm just going to name a match. Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker at WrestleMania 25. And specifically, I mean, really the whole match. It was just so fucking great. And, you know, the person who actually just asked that question about which wrestlers do I mark out for, and I said I don't, I marked out for that match. I mean, I was like a little kid watching that. And there was one moment in particular towards the end. It might have been the last big near fall in that match, where Shawn Michaels got off the super kick and kicked Undertaker in the face and had people thinking this is it. And he crawled over to the Undertaker, put his arm over his chest, and got like a 2 3/4 count before Undertaker got a shoulder up. And you could see the fans in the front row go fucking apeshit. I mean, these people were so happy that Undertaker had just kicked out. The place was going crazy. I got goosebumps at that moment, because it just, you will not find, I mean, a better match, or certainly in WWE, with as much emotion as you had on that night between two guys the caliber of Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker. That's why I watch wrestling. That right there. You know, you may watch wrestling for different reasons. This guy over here may watch wrestling because he wants to see Ring of Honor and CZW. Everybody has their reasons for liking wrestling and for still watching it or not. And in my case, that match right there, and moments like that, at that very moment, are the epitome of why I love to watch wrestling. That gave me goosebumps. That was one of my favorite moments of the last decade, at least in WWE. The other one was from a year ago, January of 2010, when Bret the Hitman Hart returned to WWE, and they did such a good job that the video packages they put together of highlights from Bret's career, the stuff from Montreal, and Shawn confronting Vince on Raw and saying, bring back Bret Hart, if you do, I promise only good things will happen, and the music they had set to that video, and the fade into the live crowd at the beginning of the show that night that Bret was coming back to host. And, you know, you had Justin Roberts do the introduction, the music hit. And at first I was a little taken aback and disappointed when I heard that the music was remixed, although I've since become a fan of Bret's new theme.
But just the build-up to that moment, because it was just so many years in the making, and Brett walking out on that stage when I and a lot of other people were convinced that we were never going to see him walk out on that stage again. Another one of those moments that gave me goosebumps, and maybe it's just that you had to be a fan in the 90s to really relate to it. I mean, if you're a younger listener and you weren't a big Bret Hart fan, you missed that whole era, and you really only started watching WWE in the past decade, Bret Hart walking out there probably didn't mean shit to you, but to me and a lot of other people, that moment right there, it was a long time in the making, and it meant a lot. And, you know, maybe part of it is that there's been great moments, but there haven't been a lot of really, really great moments that pop into my head in the last decade. But those two that I just mentioned are the two that first popped up, and those were two pretty goddamn great moments for me. So those are the ones that I wanted to name. Dylan wants to know, what was my favorite John Cena promo? It was the one that didn't have any comedy in it. So if you could find that one for me, let me know. Vincent wants to know, when did The Rock decide that he was done with pro wrestling? Was it after WrestleMania 19, or was it long before that? Any news on a return? Rock ain't coming back, so there's your news on a return. As far as when he gave up on pro wrestling, I wouldn't say he gave up on pro wrestling. When he left it, no, it wasn't WrestleMania 19, because he wrestled at WrestleMania 20. So obviously he didn't give up on it before that. WrestleMania 20, if you may recall, it was The Rock and Mick Foley in a handicap match against Randy Orton, Batista, and Ric Flair of Evolution at Madison Square Garden. Evolution won that match, and that was the last match that The Rock had at WrestleMania or anywhere else, I believe. He made a couple of appearances, maybe one or two appearances on Raw after that, and there's been one or two times, like on SmackDown, he did that thing a year or two ago when he, for SmackDown's 10th anniversary show, he taped a promo and teased maybe being a Raw guest host, which he wanted to do, and I suppose he still could. It just didn't fit into his schedule. That's why The Rock didn't guest host Raw. It had nothing to do with him having another falling out with them or anything like that. But, you know, Rock gave up the wrestling gig, if you will, after WrestleMania 20, not WrestleMania 19. And the last Facebook question for this week comes from Brian Bird, who's reading on Wikipedia that at WrestleMania 8, one of my favorite WrestleManias, Ric Flair was fined for bleeding during his match with the Macho Man Randy Savage. In the Bret Hart-Roddy Piper match earlier on that same card, though, Bret was bleeding and was not fined. Do you know if there's any truth behind this? Yes, there is, as a matter of fact. The basic story behind it is this, and Bret's talked about this, and Bret has actually admitted to pulling a fast one on Vince McMahon. The Bret Hart-Roddy Piper match, which was helped by the addition of color. You know, Bret getting busted open was part of the whole story of the match and really added a lot to it. It was a great match. That move came, I believe, on a Roddy Piper bulldog. And that's when Bret got opened up, and it was a pretty nasty cut. And Bret Hart did not blade all that much in his matches. It wasn't something he was known for. And he did it convincingly enough where, you know, it was possible that, you know, the move went awry and Bret cut himself open by accident. That's what he told Vince McMahon backstage. It was an accident. It was hard way. It was not done on purpose. And they believed him. So later on the same card, Ric Flair is bleeding all over the place like a stuck pig. His white hair turns crimson red. And Ric Flair was notorious for bleeding in his matches. He did it all the time in the NWA. And I don't know that he had bled in a WWF match up to that point. He had only been in the company for a matter of months. But he bled when the edict at the time was, there is to be no blood. And unfortunately for him, Bret Hart had already bladed earlier in the night, although Vince believed that it was an accident, but he wasn't happy about it. When he saw Flair do it, you know, Vince obviously didn't buy the fact that, you know, Flair had also accidentally gotten busted open, and he knew that this was something that Flair did in big matches, you know, from time to time. And I don't know if Ric Flair tried to convince Vince that it was an accident. I don't think that he did, the way that Bret lied about it. If he did try to convince him, Vince didn't believe him. But I don't think it was anything where he lied about it. I think he came through the curtain after a great match with Randy Savage, the match of WrestleMania 8, when Savage won the title from him with a roll-up with the tights in the middle of the show, and Flair came back through the curtain and got chewed out by Vince McMahon in front of everybody. And Vince, as the story goes, made some sort of comment to Flair, something along the lines of, you'll never learn, or something like that. And I think he fined Flair, several $1,000s for bleeding. So that is a legit story. I know Brett's talked about it before. Maybe Flair did. I read Flair's book. I don't remember if he might have mentioned something about it in his book, but there's the story. No blood policy in 1992, and now we've come full circle. No blood policy in 2011. So that's going to be it for the Facebook questions for now. There's still a whole bunch more I haven't gotten to yet. Some I skipped over. I promise I will try to get to as many of them as I can next week, and if need be, the week after. I should be able to wrap this up next week. I want to thank everybody who submitted questions. Like I said, that thread ended up with over 70 comments on Facebook. It was still growing as of a day ago. And I will do another one in the future, maybe not for a while, because I just get so much. It's just so easy for people to just post a question on the spot, more than I guess it is for them to send me an email. So got a big reaction to that, and I want to thank everybody for all the feedback. You can still email me questions to thesolemonster@gmail.com. That is the only way to, unless I'm doing a Facebook mailbag, of course, to send questions in for potential airing on this show. That's the only way to do it. So send me questions to there. That email address, twitter.com/solemonster. You can follow me on there. And, of course, facebook.com/thesolemonster. As I mentioned earlier, you need to friend me on there to see, you know, certain pictures and to participate in the Facebook mailbags and all that fun stuff. So hit me up on there if you have not already done so. Subscribe via iTunes. I've had a couple of people write in to say that they're a big fan of the show, and they only you know, the only reason they go to SE Scoops and brave the advertisements is to listen to this podcast. Well, you should go to SE Scoops anyway. It's a great website, but if you want to avoid that, then that's another reason for you to sign up for the Sound Off for free in iTunes. That way the podcast will automatically download for you. You don't have to go anywhere or do anything. So check out that feature as well. We'll be back Royal Rumble weekend with another show, episode 144 coming up. So until then, be well, stay safe. We'll see you next week, guys.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joe from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solar Monster sounds off on SEScoops.com.